Optima Tax Relief. Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
And now, Maine's best guest list, live from Bangor, this is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Welcome in, it's hour two, just like that. I'm quite ready for it here on a Wednesday afternoon. Rich Kimball, Bruce Pratt with you, Downtown, brought to you every single day by Renewal by Anderson, your trusted window and door replacement expert of Greater Maine, offering free in-home consultation and right now celebrating their 10th anniversary, but you get the savings, $299 off windows, $499 off doors, 10% off your entire purchase. Call them at 207-275-6622 or visit renewalbyanderson.com, the better way to a better window. Coming up in the 5 o'clock hour this afternoon, we'll check sports headlines, look at your weather forecast right through the weekend, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the calendar, the birthday list, and a check of the social media world on the grapevine. But up first this afternoon, we are happy to welcome back to the show a longtime music journalist. For many years was the chief pop music critic of the Los Angeles Times. He's written biographies of Johnny Cash, Paul Simon, and Bruce Springsteen, and he has got a fabulous new book out, came out just yesterday, called A Few Words in Defense of Our Country, the biography of Randy Newman. Good to welcome Robert Hilburn back to the program this afternoon. Bob, great to have you back with us. So what drew you to the story and the subject of Randy Newman?
Well, I all the years I was at the LA Times, I loved rock and roll bands. I loved, you know, all kinds of music. But I realized at the end that it was the singer-songwriter that meant the most to me. Like even, let's say, Springsteen, he's a songwriter. John and Paul are songwriters. I love the music they make, but their songwritings and their ideas. So after the Johnny Cash book, I wanted to focus on the best songwriters I thought were out there. And on a list, Rich, if say a top five, I'm leaving the four and five open. It could be Joni Mitchell. It could be Neil Young. It could be American songwriters. It could be Springsteen. I don't know. But the first three are Dylan, in whatever order, Dylan, Simon, and Newman. Okay, that was my judgment. So I do Simon, and then I want to do Newman. And they're both very private people. It took me months to convince both of them to talk to me about a book. And so the thing about Randy is he's not the big seller like Simon. People don't know him as much. So the book is a crusade to get people to better understand and appreciate Newman. And it's not because of You've Got a Friend in Me, and it's not because I love LA, and it's not Short People. Those things got on the radio and they were wonderful. But the heart of his body of work, excuse me, is the dozens of brilliant songs on his albums that talk about what he sees as the shortcomings in the American character: racism, sexism, greed, which has terrible implications, you know, wealthy ignoring the poor and the homeless and so forth, homophobia. And he's been writing about these things for 50 years. And it's more timely than ever because the country is so divided over these very issues. So it's a crusade to get people to understand and appreciate that he belongs in that tier. And in the book, I asked people, I knew that since he's not as well known, and I'll slow down after a second, but the thing is, how do you get people to do it? I'm not sure if a person wants to read a book by me saying how great he is. They might not believe it, but I wanted to get the people they respect to tell me to write original testimonials for the book about him. And the first person who sent a thing back to me was Bob Dylan, then Paul Simon, then Jackson Browne, then Don Henley, but particularly those, and Greil Marcus is a critic, Bob Christgau. I wanted to get outside of music. You can talk about Randy as much on opinion pages because of his message as on entertainment pages. And so I got Tom Friedman, you know, the New York Times. I wanted to branch out. And again, I just was trying to figure out how can I get this story told. So, and, you know, it turns, I appreciate your thoughts because I think it does make the case. Now, if we can only get people to read it.
Well, you mentioned that the subject of Randy Newman is not one that Randy is fond of talking about, but you met with him countless times and had great conversations. But I wanted to ask you, too, how important were the contributions of Lenny Waronker to making this book a reality?
Yeah, he was invaluable. I called him. I knew Randy would be reluctant because part of his upbringing, his uncles, the great film composers, Alfred Newman and so forth, were very wary of talking about their own personal life. They said, let the music speak for it, because if you say things, don't tell people about your personal life. It makes they might attack you for it and so forth. And it looks like bragging. And so Randy is very reluctant. I met with him. I knew it, had known him over the years. I reviewed his first concert ever in L.A. And I said how original I thought he was. But he was wary because he didn't want to make it look like he was bragging and didn't want to look like. And so he would talk about the music, but he got really, I could see he it was difficult when I started asking him questions. And I wasn't trying to probe into his life. I was trying to find elements in his life that influenced his creative vision. Why does he write about the underdog? Why does he write about these social issues? Because he was somewhat an underdog. He was cross-eyed. His would make fun of him. His father was trying to push him into songwriting because he wanted to become part of the musical tradition of the Newman family. There were, and he saw what was going on in the world. He loves baseball, and he saw segregation. And he loves music, and he saw how white disc jockeys in the 50s would play only the white versions. So all this stuff was natural things in his life, and but it took him a long time to figure out that was his subject matter. But once he figured it out on songs like Sail Away and Rednecks, there was no stopping him.
Well, I wrote down a wonderful quote from Randy from the book. He said, I don't write love songs and I don't write in the first person. The songs are about things that need to be noticed.
Yes, right. He said, another thing he says is in the book, he says, it was like I took the wrong fork in the road in terms of commercial success. Because by writing about these subjects, which radio would not play, they would play short people, but they didn't quite understand the songs, or he doesn't write like protest music. He writes he assumes the role of a character and speaks in that character's voice, sometimes confusing who's talking and stuff. So radio, so we don't want any part of that. It's not easy to understand. You know, Randy says a lot of times that the pop music and radio is what you listen to while you're eating potato chips. Absolutely radio. And so by continuing in that direction, he knew he was sacrificing commercial, you know, having bigger scores. It frustrated him, but he preferred writing these significant subjects rather than having a hit record.
You point out in the book, Bob, that he often turned to an unreliable narrator. And sometimes I feel like that stood in the way of larger success because so many people didn't get it, didn't understand what he was doing.
That's absolutely right. He knew that, and he willingly sacrificed it. You know, he never tried to change. He had such subtleties in some songs that people didn't really even understand. Like he has a song called Follow the Flag or Wave the Flag or something like that. And it's all about patriotism and so forth, but it's really saying you shouldn't be 100% acceptable. That leads us into wars and so forth. But even though people complained they didn't understand it, he said, well, I'm not going to change it. They should understand it. He's not trying to educate or write over people's heads, but he has his own artistic sensibilities and he tells the story the way he wants to and isn't afraid if the person doesn't understand it because he thinks it should stand by itself.
Well, and such great humor and wit in his lyrics, and humor and wit, not exactly the common vernacular of pop music, to say the least.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's very, I mean, I can't think of anybody else who uses humor as consistently and as effectively. I mean, I really don't. I mean, there's Weird Al, but that's not, that's just parody. That's just kind of, you know, to come up with original songs. But I think part of that is, I don't want to say strategy, but I think he realizes as a young boy, I remember the story in the book. He goes to a friend's house and somehow the mother asks him to sing a song, and he does a funny song or tells a joke or something, and she laughed. And so it struck him that humor is a good way to get people to listen to what you're doing. So by putting the humor in, it's entertaining, but it's also kind of softening, you know, the message in a way that makes it a bit more acceptable. Or, you know, a person might listen to it longer than they would if it was just a straight song.
Now, an early example of that, and either Sinatra either didn't get it or didn't appreciate the humor in Lonely at the Top.
You know, Warner Brothers wanted to get something more contemporary for Sinatra, and they asked Randy to write a song for him. This is just when he was beginning to be a songwriter, and he wrote this great parody that, I'm not sure it's a parody, it's a satire on a guy who's got everything in the world, and he's lonely, you know, it's like, oh, poor me, poor me. So he plays it for Sinatra, and Sinatra just says, you got anything else? but then he played it for Barbara Streisand. And she passed on it, too, because they didn't want to, that people might think that's really, it was too close.
Right,
it was
right.
Close to what they were.
We're talking with Robert Hilburn. His wonderful new book is A Few Words in Defense of Our Country, the biography of Randy Newman. And you talk about his worldview and understanding things. Can you talk a little bit about the role Lucinda Hicks played in helping him understand the world better as a young man?
I guess when he was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, but maybe a dozen years, she was the housekeeper. His mother, Randy's mother, had migraines, and she would have to stay in a room, a dark room, almost all day sometimes. So they needed somebody to come in the house and do that. And she was a Black woman from Texas. Lots of fun. She loved music. Her boyfriend loved baseball. And Randy would always joke at it because the friend loved the Yankees when the Yankees was the only team that didn't have a Black player at the time. But anyway, she would take him to the park, and she spent a lot of time with him. And she, she liked some of the music she likes, Spats Domino and stuff. But also she kind of it taught how could racism be people are so lovely as this. I mean, he grew up in a very wealthy town. I don't think he didn't have a Black classmate till he was at UCLA. Mm. But this was an entry into that world. And one day he said something. I think he said the N-word somehow. Maybe he had heard that in New Orleans when he spent a little bit of time there. But somehow, and she got took a twig off a tree and spanked him, you know. But that they just loved her, you know. He and his brother Alan loved her, and that certainly, I think, contributed more to his anger about the way people are treated.
He got a job as a young man as a songwriter for Liberty Records, and an early champion, surprise to hear, was Pat Boone.
Yeah, that's so funny because, well, to get to that point, Lenny Warnker was a neighborhood friend, okay, from the age of two. Mm. And his father owned Liberty Records, which had Julie London and Willie Nelson was on at the time, Eddie Cochran, Summertime Blues. And Lenny kept seeing Randy play the piano, and he thought he was really talented. And as the more he saw it, Lenny would hear some songs that were being sent in to Liberty for their artists to sing. And he said, Randy, you can write better than these. And he gave him, he's the one who convinced him to be a pop songwriter instead of trying to follow his uncles into film music. Okay. And every time Randy would write a song, he would call Lenny, and Lenny says, great, great. And so he got him signed at Warner Brothers Records. He produced his records and they're still friends, but he's essential to the story. But anyway, he writes this song, Golden Gridiron Boy, or Gridiron, I always forget which way it goes. And, Lenny said, he said it's great, but he didn't really think it was very good. And so somehow Randy's father, he was a doctor who had a celebrity practice, and Pat Boone was one of the people. And the doctor would hand out demo tapes of Randy's new song. So Pat goes and plays it. He calls back the doctor, hey, I like this song. I think I might record it. Then he realized, well, I can't do this. I'm in my 20s. I've got two or three children. I'm not a high school football player. So he says, how about having Randy do it? So Randy does the song, and it doesn't go anywhere. You know, it's not very good. But that was his first experience. And Pat tried to get Dot Records Publishing to sign Randy. He was only 19, but they said, "Well, let's let him have a few hits, and then we'll sign him." And they lost him.
Well, is it? Would you say it was the song "I Think It's Going to Rain Today" that really gave us the first look at what Randy Newman would become as a songwriter?
Well, yes, he spent a couple years, as all young songwriters do, trying to write at this time in the early '60s, trying to write songs that. It hits sing. This is before the rock and roll kind of took over. He would try to write a song for Bobby V or other people who had hits, and then the publisher would try to get them to sing it. So he was really doing, he wasn't doing anything that he cared about. These were songs he was trying to get on the radio, and it wasn't very interesting, and it wasn't very satisfying to him. So finally he realizes he wants to start writing songs that mean something, that he cares about. And the first great one he wrote was "I Think It's Going to Rain Today." And he always felt uncomfortable with the song, though, Rich, because in the song, the guy sounded depressed. He's, you know, he's, and Randy, and I it took me a long time because he's very difficult talking about these personal things, again, because of the influence of the Uncles. And I said, "Well, why didn't you like that song? That's the most recorded song you've ever written. You had Dusty Springfield recorded. You had, I think, Ella Fitzgerald. It was just Streisand. It was just a lot of people." And he said, "Well, I think it was too close. It was too close to him." And it's true that he tends to be more depressing, seeing the darker side. It's like a friend told me that she wakes up every morning and it's a beautiful day outside. I can't wait to get downstairs and go, you know, do things. Randy wakes up, sees the same sky, and I think it's going to rain today, and doesn't want to do anything. Doesn't want to go downstairs. Doesn't want to do interviews. Doesn't want to do anything. You know, is that so? He's always fought against that, you know, kind of closed off, don't get involved in things, but I want to make music, so I have to do that. But so it was a bit of a tension at first.
At Warner Brothers, he met another kindred spirit, a great friend of our show, Van Dyke Parks.
Yes, Van Dyke he's the great raconteur.
Yes, he is.
He can talk, and he was a great musician and stuff, he made a great album, but most people at the record company, but you had these kindred spirits. You had Van Dyke and Randy, and that was partly Lenny Warnker. He wanted original people. He said he thought the duty of a record company was to find unusual talent and different talent and new talent. But it took him a while. Randy's first two records did not. They sold like 5,000 each. He would have been dropped at other labels, but Lenny and Mo Austin at Warner's believed in him and kept him.
Well, and the first measurable success was with that third album, which is an absolute classic, Sail Away. Sold, I don't know, at one point, I think in the book you say it had crossed the 300,000 mark in sales, and Randy still viewed it as a failure.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because look, you're at Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers Records, and he sees his record, let's say the first week sells 10,000 copies. James Taylor's is selling 150,000 copies. Neil Young is selling this. Joni Mitchell is selling this. And, you know, it's like, so he liked it, but it wasn't, you know, he was like way behind these people and stuff, although he was getting as much or more praise than they were. And he has this heart. You know, of course, everybody would like to have every record artist like to have a bigger hit. But again, Randy's pretty much, he had this conviction. Again, he was sacrificing. He wouldn't have done what he did if all he wanted was a hit, you know?
Well, and Sail Away, the single, and the title cut of the album, has never been a hit, been recorded by all kinds of people. But that's got to be in anybody's top 10 of the most, I think, important and powerful songs of the pop rock era.
Yeah, you know, it was a classic. I mean, that was the first. See, so what happened was after "I Think It's Going to Rain Today," even though he started writing things that were personal to him, you know, that he cared about, he didn't really define what his subject matter was going to be. He tried this and he tried that. And then he looked around him and saw all these problems, the racial problems, injustice, bullying. And that became it. And Sail Away was the first. He was planting the flag in the ground. This is what I'm going to do. And then he goes from that
to rednecks,
which was a concept album about racism in America, told through the eyes of the South, and Rednecks. The song itself was putting the North and the South down. He was saying, "Look, this is a problem America has, not just the South." But I think rather than just put it out, because the unreliable narrator was a Southern racist, I want to try to understand what makes the racist, how he feels about other things. And that's what he did in Good Old Boys. He wrote an album that tried to explain the culture of the South.
And then 1977, Little Criminals is released with the single Short People. And I love Short People, so I'm not going after the record, but the fact that that's his biggest hit, to me, it's similar to the fact that Chuck Berry's only number one song is My Ding-a-Ling.
Is that right? Well, the thing is, and I remember, I think it was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or the Oscars, somewhere he got an award, and he's walking to the stage, and they're playing Short People, you know, as the reason. I mean, because people know that, but that meaning, what worst song could you play? Yeah. I mean, what song is the least what his artistry is? And it's a funny song, too, because he wrote it, and is it a statement of dance? Prejudice? Or just a joke, you know? And Randy's kind of easygoing. And so disc jockeys would ask him, and they were trying to support him, saying, "Well, this is really a great statement on racism, Randy." And Randy would, yeah, it is. But he just wrote it because it was funny. There was no ulterior, you know, there was no hidden message in it. He wrote it because it was funny.
And I think probably the next biggest hit in terms of chart success was I Love L.A. from Trouble in Paradise, that again was written tongue-in-cheek, but people only saw the obvious. They did not get the subtlety in it.
Yeah, you really get these things. Well, that's great. The funny thing was Don Henley is the person who suggested he write a song about Los Angeles. And he said, I hate those city songs, New York, you can make it here anywhere, Chicago, this and that. And Randy says, Don said, no, you can do that. You could be perfect on this. So he writes it. And he puts in that great line. It's about, it's wonderful, the sunshine and the girls and the cars and so forth. And this guy says, look at that bum on his knees. I mean, he's pointing out there's homelessness in this whole situation and stuff. They play it now. It's become the anthem of Los Angeles. At every Dodger game, every Ram game, every basket Laker game, it's people go walking out of the thing to that. It's a great, great song. And it's just, it's so magical because it is a criticism of celebrating everything and forgetting the people who are left behind.
One of my favorite Randy Newman albums is Land of Dreams, which I thought in a lot of ways, at least up until that point, was maybe his most personal album, with songs like Four Eyes and Dixie Flyer, I Want You to Hurt Like I Do.
Yeah. It was a really good record. And a lot of people mention that song, I Want You to Hurt Like I Do. I'm surprised how many people tell me that's their favorite Randy Newman song. It's really interesting, you know, and it's very personal. It talks off about having his divorce, leaving his family and so forth. But it again, so he gets back to that depression thing we start off with. And I guess he's not quite as sensitive about it now as he was in the beginning. But it is a song that he talks about it like it's kind of a joke. It's like, do we have We Are the World, we're all happy. Well, why don't we get a song, you know, a big We're All Unhappy.
he dabbled in film work with Norman Lear, the film Cold Turkey back in the early 1970s, but really came to fruition many years later. And one of the big early successes was his work on Parenthood. And I love to see his smile that became such a crucial component of that movie.
Yeah. Well, he was so intimidated by going into the film world because he saw how hard it was. Alfred Newman thought his success was a fluke, and that and Randy would sit there and he would see how hard he struggled on it and stuff. How can I live up to this? It's so hard. It's so difficult. But finally, he does Cold Turkey. And then he does Ragtime, I think, was the second one. But the first great one he did was The Natural.
Yeah.
Barry Levinson. And he has that great scene in it. It's still played in sports documentaries all the time, where Redford hits the home run and the light tower shatters. And it's a beautiful theme. And then he did Parenthood, which was very good. But then he did another, Avalon. So his first two great things were The Natural and Avalon. Barry Levinson, totally in sync. And the thing was, it's so funny about short people, is that when he went to talk to the studio about The Natural, they said, "Well, who's going to do the music?" And and he says, "Randy Newman." And it was a pause. "You mean that short people guy?" And he had to really fight to get them to do it. He says, "No, listen to Sail Away and these songs with Americana. There is this other thing." And then the thing after the trouble with, I mean, if you talk a little bit about the film thing, he got stereotyped. People, we want to, if they, it was a comedy, they said, "We ought to have Randy Newman do this kind of stuff." And he didn't get offered a lot of great, he's had stupid movies like Leatherheads and Maverick and Meet the Falkers and these kind of things. And so he was wanting more serious drama. And then finally Toy Story hits, and that was huge. And I think he started getting financially, boy, that was a windfall. And it was so sweet and stuff. And he did so many of those kind of cartoon things. There's a story one time he was talking to his agent. And he says, "Can you please get me something other than another tune?" and then he was very happy later more recently when he did Marriage Story. So that was getting him back to the drama that he wanted. So he could have had a much better film catalog. He got 22 Grammy Oscar nominations,
right.
But he could have had a much better if he had better films, you know, more challenging films.
One of the, I think, most interesting stories in the book, Bob, is the tale of the creation of the musical Faust.
Yes, yes. And Randy says maybe that's his favorite thing that he ever did. It was bringing all of his feelings together. It's about God versus the devil, good versus evil, morality. It was a lot of commentary in that, but it's also very humorous, you know, and it just didn't work as a play. You know, it works. Mm. The music's fine, but just like Paul Simon's Cape Man, it doesn't work. The story doesn't quite tell. And so it didn't ever catch on as a play. And they've done a couple concert versions where they just do the music from it. That's a little bit more successful, but it's considered a it's considered a mess. And he says, when I asked him about what his favorite memories and achievements, he says, "I know people think it was a mess, but to me, it was one of my favorite things I ever did."
And he, of course, had all the great success with film work, especially those tunes in the 90s and the 2000s. But then released a trio of albums that stand with his very best of all time, with Bad Love, Harps and Angels, and Dark Matter. They are right there with the early classics, I think.
Yeah, I want to applaud you for that, because that's so true, you know. And he did so many albums. After Toy Story, he did so many film scores. A lot of his fans said, "Well, he's never going to make albums again," you know. And he realized at some point, look, the most important thing I've ever done, most significant thing, is those significant songs, those albums. I've got to go back. So he stopped away from, you know, $1 million a picture he was getting probably. And he does those. And he's nearing 60 when he starts that. Yeah. That's an unheard of age for rock and roll. I mean, think of all the artists who've, you know, they start losing their steam after in the 30s and the 40s. My God. So he goes back and does that, and he's a better artist because he's done all those film things, and he brings more subtlety to the arrangements. He'll do just a 10-second flute thing in a song. People probably don't even notice it, but it's gorgeous, and the songs have a maturity. They're more personal in some way. They deal with mortality. Those last three albums, I think, are as good or better than Sail Away and Good Old Boys. It's an argument that, you know, you could go either way, but I think they're just tremendous. And if I gave somebody an album of Randy Newman, I might start with Dark Matter, because it's got so many great songs on it.
Well, as you say in the book, Bob, I mean, there are artists that maybe have not made a bad album. You say Randy Newman hasn't even made a mediocre album.
Yeah, well, no, actually, that was Bob Christgau who said that.
Oh, okay.
Critic. Yeah, he said he went through all these artists who've done great work and stuff, but they've all made mediocre albums at some point. But Randy's never even made a mediocre album.
There's a wonderful moment late in the book, and it really, in many ways, brings his story full circle, and that's the concert with his cousins at the Hollywood Bowl in 2018.
Yeah, to me, that's really a memorable night. That was because there was always this issue, Alfred Newman's sons and to Randy's father, his son. See, he wanted to be part of the Newman musical tradition. So he really pushed Randy into music, trying to make him do that, which put a lot of pressure on Randy. But so that night is when the two, Randy got together with one of Alfred's sons, and it was the first time they had ever been on stage together. So Thomas Newman, David Newman, everybody was out, the family. It was a wonderful moment in the history of the family. And it was just a great concert. And backstage, I asked a guy who had managed Randy in the early days, what's the difference between Randy now and back in the, when he was beginning? And he said, two, he's more relaxed. He's now got over the intimidation. He's proven himself. And he also said he also loved the way Randy's family was. He had gone through a divorce and he was afraid the kid, he was going to lose, friendship with his children, love with his children. And they were still the kids from his second marriage. They were all together and bonded. And so it was a great, he wanted to be a good father. And he, that night he was clear and he was accepted that he was back in the family tradition. And Thomas Newman told me one thing that was really interesting to me. He's such a fan of, I mean, Thomas, who has dozens of film nominations, Grant himself, he's such a fan of Randy. He just started talking. The first 50 minutes, he wouldn't stop about how much he admired Randy and how intimidated he was about by Randy, just as Randy was intimidated by Alfred. And he said, in fact, he's the greatest Newman of all. And I said, really? I wouldn't have said that because it would look like hype if I were doing it in the book. And I said, are you sure about that, Thomas? He says, I'm sure. And my father could never have written these songs that Randy. So Randy could vaguely do what Alfred did, but no one could do those songs. And that's a great, I think it's true, but I don't think, I'm glad I wouldn't have said it. I've been nervous about saying it.
Do you think from your conversations with him that Randy understands how well respected he is by his peers in music?
Well, I think that means so much to him. He says, "Look, I'm not sure I can ever reach millions of fans, although he did with You Got a Friend in Me. But I think I want the peers." And on his first album, he got a note from McCartney. I think Brian Wilson was saying, "I mean, he got it from the beginning that thing." And now look at the praise now. I mean, Dylan and Simon and all these people, he's just so admired by them. And he's got the respect of the studio musicians, which he always, I'm talking about the film musicians and the orchestras and just the players on his own albums. And yes, that means so much to him. I think if he had only had that, Rich, he would have been in a, you know, he would have been his career would be, in his eyes, been a success.
I'm glad you mentioned the musicians on those film scores, because that was a very interesting part of the book as well. When you talked to some of them about what it was like when he would come into the room and his ability to hear things and be able to find just the right moment to bring that score to life.
Yeah, and also he was very funny as a conductor. He would loosen them up, and they respected him because a lot of film people would go to London and get all these studio musicians and stuff, but he got the Hollywood people. He really had faith in him and stuff. And the great line was when they did the first Disney movie, he told them, and the Disney executives were there. And the Disney was often criticized for the music in some of their films. It was a little, corny and stuff. And he said, "Well, this is a Disney film, so we gotta, whatever it was, we gotta, do your best or whatever it is." They're sitting there, but everybody, he's so good-natured that they get the joke, the executives.
Do you think he's got another studio album in him?
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. He's had a terrible 5 years physically. He's had a dozen, I mean, I don't know, I mean, 8, 9, 10 operations on his neck and his back. Sometimes they last 10 hours. So that takes months of physical therapy and recovering from it. And he's worked a few songs. He's tried a couple here and a couple there. And Lenny's there all the time trying to get him. Maybe we can record some of the movie songs in and out. Lenny's trying to guide him into doing that. But it's just a matter of how it's physical, how well he is physically, because he was in no shape for a few years. He's gotten much better recently, so I'm awfully hopeful, and they're hopeful. You know, they haven't given up.
You know, the mark to me of a great music biography is when you do what I did, and having listened to these songs for more than 50 years, to read the book, to put it down, and then to go re-listen to some of that music and get a new appreciation of it because of the way you've brought it to life again in this wonderful book.
Oh, that's great. Because again, you know, this really was a crusade to say, look, we've got this great American songwriter in our midst, and we don't, and too many people don't realize it, you know? And it's just, there's so much to be gained from it, not only praise for him, but, you know, information and insight and passion and things that you get from the music.
Well, it is a terrific read. A Few Words in Defense of Our Country, the biography of Randy Newman. You won't be able to put it down. You won't want to. The newest book from Robert Hilburn. Bob, it's so great to talk with you again.
Yeah, Rich, and you really read the book well. I've never gone through an interview where a person had read the book as fully as you did. That's great.
Well, the only way to do it, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, that's great.
But it makes it easier when it's a great read.
Thanks so much. That's just great to hear.